on Straight Talk Africa. It's been a year and a few days since President Donald Trump's inauguration. Observers say his administration has had some major victories and setbacks. So, what does his report card really look like? And what's the way forward for the administration? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all of our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll reflect on U.S.-Africa policy during President Donald Trump's first year in office.
And coming up later, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook and Twitter comments. We'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
President Trump's challenging first year was unlike any other in recent U.S. political history. And 2018 could be more of the same. My colleague Jim Malone has more.
For America's 45th president, it was a bold beginning.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
President Trump moved swiftly to cut Obama-era regulations and filled a vacancy on the Supreme Court. His biggest victory came in December, a sweeping tax cut bill.
This is the bill right here, and we're very proud of it. It's going to be a tremendous thing for the American people. It's going to be fantastic for the economy.
Passage of the tax bill could help Republicans in this year's congressional elections, says analyst John Fortier.
Republicans did get a tax bill passed, a significant tax bill in December. That was a major accomplishment for them, so that is something that has put them on a better track.
Mr. McCain. No.
But Trump's first year saw plenty of setbacks as well. There was a failed attempt to repeal Obamacare, numerous outbursts on Twitter, and at times inflammatory presidential rhetoric, including Trump's recent reported vulgar description of Haiti and African countries.
The United States remains a very important partner for Africa. United States is one country that we hope that we continue to have good working relationships. However, we must emphasize that we need to engage each other as equal, capitalized equal partners. Not higher, not lower, but equal. So the sentiments, if they were indeed portrayed in the manner that they were, they're disappointing, saddening, and it's clear from the outrage that has been voiced by not only the African leaders, but people around the globe.
Trump's controversial and at times polarizing leadership style continues to hurt his poll ratings, despite a strong economy, says analyst John Hudak.
I think people are judging him on a variety of other factors other than the economy, and that explains his lower approval rating.
Donald Trump has got to go.
Trump's historically low presidential approval rating could also fuel Democratic gains in the November congressional elections. For 2018, Trump hopes a strong economy will improve his poll numbers. But the prospect of election losses in November and a Russia probe with no end in sight could make Trump's second year in office even more challenging than his first. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you very much, of course, for that report, Jim Malone. Now, joining us here in the VOA studios are two distinguished guests, Ambassador Robin Renee Sanders, CEO, Feed the Advocacy Initiative, and Joseph J. Slavik, political advisor and Republican supporter of President Donald Trump. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say frankly that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity for the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shaka.
Pleasure.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give you, our audience, a chance to call in with your question or comment. The number to call is 202-619-3111. His country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately. Joe, what is your assessment, frankly, of your president, President Trump, so far?
Thank you, Sean. Thank you for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure.
You're most welcome.
I think it's been a fairly successful year. Some minor setbacks, but I think overall for a political neophyte, he's done beyond better than expected.
What are some of the major accomplishments in your view?
Wow, I mean, there's countless of them. Actually, this morning I called one of the president's advisors to ask him, hey, let's go over some of the list. And the list was quite long, actually. So you've got Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed. You have the removal of the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You have the issues of immigration. Illegal immigration is down. You've got tax cuts. You've got stock market at an all-time high. Consumer confidence is at an all-time high. So I think there's quite a few, positive things that one could credit the president for.
What about you, Robin?
Well, I think that if I look at the foreign policy side of the dynamic, particularly in the region where I've worked the most in Africa, I think there is a concern that the U.S. is sort of disengaging from the continent to some extent. I just spent a month out there, and that's what I heard the most. So this is what I'm sharing with you, what I heard, as opposed to my
Which
opinion on that.
Which parts of the continent
I was in both West Africa and in Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is a little bit of that kind of concern that we're not talking about Africa enough, we're not engaged enough, and there's uncertainty of what our policy toward Africa would be. So I'm still hopeful that we will have a stepped-up engagement on the continent. I think there's a receptivity to that, and they're just waiting to see if that's going to happen.
It is very interesting that you mentioned that there are some people on the continent who wonder what sort of foreign policy, you know, if there were any, it would be. Because the next question, in fact, I was going to ask you, what is the U.S. foreign policy towards Africa from your vantage point, really?
Well, what I've heard from those in the administration is that there's going to be a stronger emphasis and focus on business and on trade. And some of the other elements that we are used to engaging on will take a back seat to those two elements. My viewpoint, and I was actually pleased to see the National Security Strategy for 2018, which came out in December of 2017, because it really talks about the whole wide range of things that we've always done on the continent. And so I'm hoping that that's going to be the blueprint that we're going to continue to follow. But what I hear the most is the business and trade aspect of the discussion. And my my point of view on that is that you still have to have good governance and an enabling environment for business and trade to flourish. One of my former bosses, Secretary of State Colin Powell, I don't know whether he coined this or what have you, but I first heard it from him. He said that business and money does not like instability and weak environments. So we've got, even if we push the idea of business and trade, which I agree with, we also still have to push the governance, democracy, and transparency aspects, because those go hand in hand with good business and good trade.
What do you mean by saying that business and money does not like instability? Let's face it, America has been doing business, for example, with the Democratic Republic of Congo, which at one time was Zaire under Mobutu Sese Seko for 32 years.
I think that, you know, that's kind of the old Cold War model of business and trade, and I think we've changed, at least in the last decade, from that model for a long period of time. And we now expect to deal with partners who are have good governance, that focus on transparency, that focus on fighting corruption. Those are the things that have become the pillars, the staples of U.S. policy in the region. And I expect those to continue, because I think that with the new business framework and the new trade framework, you have to have those things.
You have to have those things. What about you, Joe? I mean, when someone talks about support effective governance. I mean, there are a lot of people who will tell you, if you look at the Great Lakes region of Africa, for example, you look at Central Africa and what have you, there's no such a thing there, really.
Well, let me first comment on Robin. I think she hit the nail on the head as to where the Trump administration is on Africa and its policy. I think it's forthcoming, and probably in the next 3 months, there will be a politically appointed Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. So I think once that person's in place, they'll have a more of a mandate with the Secretary of State and the President to really undertake the President's agenda. With regard to Central Africa, there's the difference of effective state versus effective control. So there's a lot of people that have effective control of the country, but should we say democracy is not as prevalent. So there's the give and take there.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that within the next 3 months, we are going to see someone in charge of Africa actually being appointed. The question is, who is currently in charge of the African store? Is this normal? Because, look, we've always seen an Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs being appointed at least before May. What happened?
Well, originally there was a person appointed, and there was some pushback from the Senate, so that person's candidacy was withdrawn. The administration in November submitted another name, and I believe they're being vetted. But currently you have Ambassador Yamamoto, who's pretty competent and capable. He's been around for some time and has served in that capacity. You have Cyril Sarter, who's at the National Security Council. So these are people both with long histories and expertise. And I think between General McMaster and Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, I think Africa is okay for the time being. I don't see any major issues with regard to policy, whether it be economic, political, or military.
Ambassador Sanders, a president of any country, any president, is considered a fountain of honor. From what I hear, from what I read from Africa, they seem to have problems with the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, I mean, who sits in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is up to the American people. So, that part I don't necessarily agree with. We don't dictate necessarily who sits in the presidency of other countries. So whoever is our president is the president of the United States. But what I would add to that, though, is I'm a policy advocate, of course, as you know, a longtime policy advocate. And so what I'm advocating for and the people that I work with is good policy. And that's got to come first. I will agree certainly that the Africa Bureau at State Department is in good hands with Acting Assistant Secretary Ambassador Yamamoto. He's a longtime career Foreign Service officer.
But does he have a mandate?
He has a mandate because he's in that job. And you can't be in that job if you don't have a mandate. He was put there by the leadership until such time that a political appointee was named. And he is, if you actually look at some of the statements coming out of the Africa Bureau, you will see that Ambassador Yamamoto and his entire team, they're still following the framework that you see in the current national security strategy. So I'm okay with that. But what I'm not okay with is stepping back from talking about governance and democracy and transparency as part of the framework that goes along with business and trade.
Yeah, because there are some people, frankly, who say they are reminded of the Nixon administration when its policy towards Africa was, in their view, not mine, benign neglect.
I would hate to see, that I recently wrote a book that talks a little bit about this period of time. And, for those of us who've worked on Africa a long time, I don't want to see us harking back to the pre-2000 period. Where we had this benign neglect. We didn't see Africa as a strategic partner. There is no way today that you can disregard a continent that's currently 1.5 billion people, on course to be 2.4 billion people by 2035. On top of that, there's an IMF stat that I quote all the time because it's so overwhelming, is that if you look at the working population of the rest of the world, that means the U.S., China, Europe, Asia, Africa will have the largest working population in the world of that combined. So if you combine all of those together, they will be greater, and they will be all under the age of 40 for the most part. So if you're looking
at... And better educated, perhaps?
Extremely so. And if you're looking
probably
at...
Probably one of the largest middle classes anywhere.
Absolutely. It's a growing middle class. It's a growing small and business enterprise class as well. So if you're looking at trade and investment hypothetically alone, who are you going to trade with if you're not going to focus on Africa and make it a strategic partner on top of the security elements that are there?
Interesting. Before we pause for a short break, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming live on Facebook. To watch our show, just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and don't forget to share it with your friends. We are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA President Trump, and we'll air some of your comments later in the show. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
I mean, the economy is on the up and up, but I think that a lot of that is also due to the policies that were put in place when Obama was in the presidency.
The year is a good year so far, you know, and people are going to have more money now.
We're all immigrants, so how dare you look down on any other?
I agree with him, and I immigrated from China legally. I follow all the rules and spent like 15 years getting my citizenship. So I think everybody should follow the same rule, follow the law.
We went through 8 years of not a whole lot being done. So, yeah, I think that he's doing a good job with terrorism.
You can't be soft, man. You got to be strong and stern. You know, you got to be strict. You know, you got to lay the rules down, man. And I think he's doing a good job.
When he came in, that's what he said. He don't want to be a president of the world. He want to be the president of America.
I think that he is putting America first in the minds of the rich white man. I think that he's not putting the whole American society first.
For many people who I personally and professionally serve, it's making things a lot harder and a lot worse.
Well, I don't think it's within his power to make America great or not. I think that's within the power of the citizens of the United States of America.
Very interesting, Joe. One of the clips say that he is actually making America first in the eyes of the white rich man. Are you included in those rich white
actually,
rich men?
I'm the son of two immigrants, so I would say that that probably doesn't apply to me. But I think there was a lot of frustration in the United States, and let's be frank. I mean, who would have thought that? Barack Hussein Obama would have ever been elected president with just with the name over 10 years ago. And
by Americans,
by Americans,
who
absolutely,
in fact were young white Americans.
Yeah, and now you've got a businessman, you know, who's basically a political neophyte who's elected. So, you know,
elected by middle America, some would say.
By Main Street, as most people would say. But I think that's the great thing about our system, that if you work hard, anything is possible. And you know, hopefully the next 4 years, the president will continue to learn to be a better swamp dweller and become more presidential. I mean, there are some mistakes that are made. And like I said, you've got a man who was a construction mogul. He was a real estate person. And, you know, obviously, I think some of his previous behavior, has come into the White House. And I think he's still learning to be a little more politically correct.
I one time, in fact, lived in some of the apartments of his father. In Rego Park, New York. Now, what about you, Robin? Talk to me. You had, of course, some of the clips talking about how people who look like you and me probably are, you know, marginalized. Do you feel like the president represents your concerns?
I think there's two parts to that. I was listening very closely to the comments, and I think what the comments represent is really how America is today. You have these silos of how people feel. So what I would like to see is us come back to a general sense of what American values are, and that everybody feels included. I don't think that this dichotomy that you actually saw in terms of the people that you interviewed, I don't think it's healthy for the nation. Everybody has to feel that it's one America, and mm-hmm. that we are working together for the betterment of everyone. And if people don't feel that way, if I can't say whether it's most of Americans or half of Americans or what have you, but whatever the case is, you have a significant amount of Americans that feel differently about where we are today as a country. And that's not healthy for us as a nation. When I look back at my career overseas, you know, working on democratic processes and elections and all of that, you know, I also analyze the U.S. in the same way if I was a political officer assigned here. And so you've got to have this unity of purpose here where everybody feels that they're part. So one of the things I hope to see the president do is to try to bring people together, because that's the only way we're going to be successful. This feeling that there are two Americas doesn't serve us well as a nation. It doesn't serve us well with our strategic partners. And it certainly doesn't serve us well for the younger generation in terms of what they would like to see America do and be and all of those kinds of things that we all work toward.
So you would like him to use his pulpit to figure out a way of uniting people?
Yes, I think that's very important. We've been known for that as a value in our system. And so I think it's very important to bring that back home. And I would like, I'm hoping this time next year we're not having the same conversation where there are silos in America that where people don't feel like they're being represented by the administration that's in power. I hope that we all come together so that we feel like we're one America. But it is, when I travel around the U.S. and I have extensively doing speaking engagement, there is this division. And I don't think that is what America has represented in the past and what we shouldn't represent in the future.
You see, usually the individual that occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is not only viewed as a president of America, but is also, in fact, a global leader. Because America, the last time I checked, happens to be the only superpower so far. It's also supposed to be a leader of the quote-unquote free world. And yet, when you see what is happening across the Atlantic and what have you, they seem to be on the same page with some of the Americans. In fact, we have had. You saw the vote, for example, at the United Nations regarding Jerusalem becoming the headquarters or the capital of Israel. And you saw the vote. What does that say to you?
Well, if you're asking me, I would say that it's reflective of how America is being viewed today. As I said, you know, I was just in the region. There is this concern that we are regressing in our relationship with Africa. And I was listening, as you know, Davos began today, the World Economic Forum, and I was listening before I came here to French President Macron, and Angela Merkel spoke, and President Modi from India opened the event.
The Prime Minister of India.
Yeah, Prime Minister of India opened the event. And so the main theme, I guess, they all had was that, you know, we all need to work on these major global issues together. And they continually mentioned climate change as a challenge, that we're no longer part of the climate change agreement, that we have a challenge with immigration across the world, how are we going to handle that? And there was a discussion about whether globalization should go away permanently because it really hasn't helped the less fortunate. When you look at the fact that 82% of the world's wealth is still owned by 1% of the world's population, where the 3.7 billion rest of the world is still left behind, that's a problem. And that includes those at-risk communities in the United States. So I would like us to re-engage with the world, still be a global leader in the world, and still take our values and share them throughout the world like we have in the past. That's what I would like to see, and I'm hoping going forward as things settle down after we've reached the year anniversary, that we will look at the global picture a little differently and start to re-engage on some of these major issues that still have an impact on us here at home.
Very interesting. What about you, Joe? I know that you cast your vote for President Trump, a very strong supporter of President Trump. What does he need to do in order for him to make you vote for him next time around?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, I think when you look at President Trump, he is an economic nationalist. I mean, you have to understand the United States has $21 trillion in debt, and there's no way we can sustain that magnitude of debt. So I think in terms of why he got elected, people voted for him because they felt they were not part of that other half. I mean, it was sort of a frustration. So I think if the president continues to focus on domestic matters, getting the economy going, bringing jobs back, you just saw Apple making a $360 billion commitment to repatriate money into the U.S. I think those are the things that really resonate with him domestically. So I think as long as his domestic house is in order, he can continue to focus overseas. As you saw when the president gave his inaugural speech, he basically made it pretty clear to note that we were not going to meddle in the affairs of other countries unless they were of national security interest. So if you look at Iraq and ISIS, you can see obviously ISIS has been diminished considerably. We have the issues of North Korea. So in a way, when I was in Africa myself, there's definitely a yearning to hear about what the U.S. position towards Africa is.
Does it mean that America is abdicating its responsibility as the lone superpower? We're talking about the moral obligation here, especially about democracy, about civil liberties, about rule of law.
I think you definitely see 2018, I'm very confident that you will see the U.S. administration very active in Africa, and I'm told sometime in the early summer there'll be an event that will be directed towards African heads of state, whether it be held here in Washington or be held in Africa somewhere. I think you will definitely see more engagement with Africa in 2018.
I see.
Let me just add to that. I agree with the premise about, you know, you've got to take care of home first. You definitely do. But I also wonder about this idea of, you know, the job aspect of the dialogue, because part of jobs includes trade. And one thing is not disconnected to the other. So that's the thing that I don't really quite agree with.
They are not mutually exclusive.
They're not mutually exclusive by any means. And so if you're looking at creating jobs back here, one of the things I say when I'm out doing my speech stump is, when you're looking at jobs back here, if you're looking at creating manufacturing jobs, for instance, just take that as an example, who are you going to sell those to if you're not looking at other partners across the world, particularly Africa, given the size of its market, $3.4 trillion market?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not mutually exclusive. So I think that there's got to be a broader understanding of how those two things are connected, even if you're looking at not even the trade aspect, but just the fundamental goods and services aspect. One of the things that AGOA does, or using U.S. EXIM does, is to purchase U.S. goods and services. So that's connected to the business element, too. So you've got the jobs part that's connected to the rest of the world, and you've got just domestic business if you're looking at sales of goods and services. So somehow those two things have to come together. Even if you just sort of said hypothetically that's all we're going to do, you can't disconnect that from working with transparent governments or democratic governance. You can't disconnect the two.
You
can't disconnect it from jobs, even just domestic jobs. You can't disconnect it from, and you certainly can't disconnect it from trade.
I remember, in fact, the former U.S. President Barack Obama saying that even with the prosperity, without freedoms, for example, it is a form of fundamental poverty.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Yeah, I think it is a fundamental part of poverty. You know, you add the gender inequality to that. You add human rights to that. You add lack of transparent processes. For instance, our businesses that want to do business overseas to even increase jobs back here, mm-hmm. if they're not dealing with a transparent government on that side mm-hmm. for a fair business deal, mm-hmm. they're going to be at a disadvantage.
Socio-cultural insensitivity?
Yeah, I think that there is a part of that, too. I mean, I think that this whole kerfluffle, and that's, I'm being very diplomatic in that term, in the last, you know, 10 days or so, over whether what was said or what wasn't said.
We'll come back to that later in the show.
I'm just going to finish up what was said or not said. I think that there is a sense of having more understanding of how those kinds of things impact how people view us.
Very interesting. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
This is a country that I chose to become a citizen. I didn't have to become a citizen. I chose to become a citizen.
I feel like America gave me an opportunity to pursue my passion as an artist.
I really believe that clean eating is a way to a more successful life, or a happier life, if you want to put it that way.
One of the things that helps me wake up every morning is doing better, being better.
We grew up poor, and so I'm always focused on helping the working class be able to have a more comfortable lifestyle.
I'm passionate about doing justice every day. I oftentimes say that justice is a verb, not a noun. You know, I believe in action and moving the ball forward.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidiyuwat, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in our social media reporter, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick. Take it away, Heidi.
Thank you very much, Shaka. This is a hot topic, and we've received a lot of social media feedback this week. U.S. President Donald Trump marked his first year in office on Saturday, January 20th. The president's tumultuous first year was unlike any other in recent U.S. political history. And this leads us to our question of the week, in which we asked, how do you feel about U.S. President Donald Trump's first year in office? And so this is what Africans had to say. We'll start with a tweet from Kwaje Lasu, who tweets, the price of democracy and the democratic system, you get what you vote for, especially when you vote with your feet. Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury sums it up very well. We have another tweet from Ben and Fred, who says, the mere fact that Donald Trump will be completing a year as president of the United States in a couple of days is testimony enough that he is a genius. And our last tweet is from Philip Onan, who tweets, he's like a democratic experiment gone wrong. He's been disruptive and polarizing. However, it confirms my conviction that Africa should not look to the West to solve its issues. We must look within ourselves. Also, that their interest has always been self-serving. Now it's public knowledge. Now to our social media comment of the week from Facebook fan Greens Kasime from Uganda, who writes, U.S. President Donald Trump has scored a number of achievements and promoted democracy in developing countries, especially in Africa. He has not interfered in the democracies of other countries. Opposition leaders on the continent had hopes that Trump could be used in the internal political affairs of the individual countries. However, Trump's achievements outweigh his failures. Let's go now to another comment from Facebook fan Akuzihe Azikiwe from Malawi, who has this question. Is he okay upstairs? And our last Facebook comment comes from Mazuba Chimobo from Zambia. He writes, in Africa, I view him as a dangerous racist capable of dividing the world. Well, a reminder, of course, that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. If you are a new fan, do drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. And to comment on our Facebook page, just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. And be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. To join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV to Africa and do follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa, of course, streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, or simply go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. And to watch us live on your mobile device, download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's coming up on next week's show. On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the death of 38-year-old Ugandan refugee Alfred Olango, who was shot and killed by police in California in September 2016. His death was among several captured on video in a year when anger over U.S. police shootings, particularly of black men, rose to new heights. Olango's status as a Ugandan refugee brought international attention, not only to the issue of race, but how police react to people who may have psychiatric problems. VOA and our partner station NBS TV in Kampala teamed up to examine what happened and whether the shooting could have been prevented. The death of Alfred Olango on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is it for today's social media segment. Shaka, of course, that gives you and the guests a lot of social media fodder, lots of differing opinions. So I'll hand it back to you.
Well, thanks, Heidi, of course, for sharing some social media reaction with us. And, of course, welcome back. And today's topic is a reflection on U.S.-Africa policy during President Donald Trump's first year in office. Our distinguished guests for today are Ambassador Robin Renee Sanders, CEO Feeds Advocacy Initiative, and Joseph J. Slavik, political advisor and Republican supporter of President Donald Trump. Well, Robin, of course, and Joe, again, I have to say I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Your reaction, Joe, you listen to a lot of those social reactions.
I mean, it's my mind, or my opinion is that it's good to have compliments and criticism. So I think from President Trump's point of view, as you know, he's quite fond of social media and monitoring the press, whether it be TV or press. And I think he's a work in progress, to say the least.
He's a work in progress.
He's a work in progress, absolutely. He's, you know, he's obviously brand new to the political system. He's never run for any office before. I think he's, without a doubt, a businessman, a TV celebrity. So, working in the White House, particularly the Oval Office, takes quite an exceptional person to do it. And I think that he's done a pretty good job. And I think every year that goes by, he'll become more and more knowledgeable, and he'll know how to deal with the trappings of the office.
Very interesting. Dr. Robin Renee Sanders, we should, by the way, inform the audience that you served as U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and what used to be called Congo Brazzaville.
Mm-hmm. So, and to ECOWAS.
And ECOWAS, that is true, yeah. So what about you? Your reaction to what you just heard?
I think that what we saw on social media was very similar to the on-street interviews that you did. And what I said earlier was that there is a dichotomy of views, or these two silos of whether he's done a good job or whether he's divided and made the country less unified, and the same kind of thing toward our behavior and foreign policy. So I think what we saw on social media is reflective of the dichotomy that we have here in the U.S. and the silos. But what I would add, though, is I think when you look particularly at Africa, one of the things that I think is really important to do is to change that perception that we don't care.
You are talking about the President of the United States?
Yeah, I think there's a perception by some from the social media comments that
right.
we don't care about Africa.
But what about the Africans themselves?
In terms of?
In terms of changing the perception.
About the continent?
Yes.
Well, I think that that's extremely important. You can't
it's a two-way
have
track.
It's absolutely a two-way process. There was one of the social media comments that talked about African leaders, and I think that mm-hmm. that's definitely a avenue where it has to be strengthened. Democracies have to be strengthened. Election processes have to be strengthened. And what we've seen, I think, in the last...
We have to have elections, not fake elections.
I think what we've seen in the last 18 months is a little bit of regression on the continent in terms of fair and free elections. Mm-hmm. And what I worry about the most, I think, in terms of the elements, is really the election commissions. We've seen some challenges with election commissions in Kenya, in Zambia and Gabon and others. And I'm hoping that, you know, that is an area
in
where...
In Uganda
and a number of
in
places.
In Rwanda.
So I think that going back to the basics on democracy, we really need to do. This retrenchment or this regression that we've seen in the last 18 months or so, we have a number of elections coming up this year, as you know.
Yes.
And so I think that it's really important to have fair and transparent election processes, because you can't have a fair and transparent democracy without fair and transparent election
processes.
In
which case, you really have to have some kind of independent electoral commission,
right.
Not simply by calling it independent.
Right, exactly. And that's what I said. You know, the last 18 months, I've been very concerned about the electoral commissions that we've seen. And so I think all of those things together, but the main point that I think was the thread through the social media comments was that we don't want to see the U.S. retrench from Africa. We want to see it engaged in Africa. But we want to see it engaged in the right way, that you're focusing on democracies, add business and trade, which I think is extremely important, but you've got to have those transparent, enabling environments to succeed. And the last thing we haven't talked a lot about, but I think is extremely important, is over the last same 18 months, I would add, you've seen both Al-Qaeda and its affiliates and ISIS kind of use Africa as its next playground.
Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab, you've got
Boko Haram.
But those are national entities that are using ISIS tactics to advance. And so there's no question that there's a strategic element to our policy with Africa, and that has to be the case. On top of the democracy, the election processes, and all of those kinds of things.
Now, talking about perceptions, of course, you are one of the very many American former ambassadors that signed a very important letter that you sent to the president.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
There was an effort by 78 former U.S. ambassadors to Africa to at least... tell the president our story about the continent that we have worked on, that we
the
have
Africa that you know,
that I know, that we have worked with, that we have represented the American people and American policies in. And what prompted the letter, whether these reports are, you know, true or inaccurate or take bits and pieces, was sort of the media storm on whether or not various derogatory comments were said toward the continent. Well, I was dismayed. I don't know what words were used, but clearly something happened that called for this media storm. But we wanted to go on record saying that Africa is important. It's important to the U.S. We know it firsthand. We want to see our engagement remain on the continent, and we want to see our engagement remain across the board in the areas that I've already highlighted.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting you talk about the derogatory language allegedly used by the president. People forget that a former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, himself, who really used to love Africa because of exactly what, you know, some of his policies, he once actually was quoted as saying that Africa was a scar on our conscience.
A scar.
A scar.
Mm-hmm.
He once said that. I mean, there are other literatures, for example, that also point towards Italy, a European country.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, it was actually referred to as the sick man of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Italy took advantage of that, and guess what? It's now like a world power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are lots of examples in history where we have not said or done the right thing in terms of Africa. Absolutely. I actually took Tony Blair's comment a little bit differently, because I thought he meant at that time, when in the context that he was saying, is that it's a scar on us because we haven't done the right thing. That's
maybe
how I took that
at
the time when I heard that comment. So again, you never know what people really mean by what they're saying. But the bigger
when you look at some of the governments that Tony Blair has supported on the African continent, sometimes you wonder.
Well, you could even say that about the U.S. pre-2000. Our behavior and the governments that we supported were not...
Is it about the individuals that occupy State House or the African people themselves?
It always should be about the African people. That has not always been the case, but that should be the end game. I I thought, as a representative of the U.S., from about 2000, I would say six or seven or so, that we were actually moving in the right direction on the continent, focusing more on the people, doing things like YALI and Power Africa, and certainly President Bush, you know, in terms of his extreme advancement on AGOA and Clinton starting AGOA and all of those kinds of things. So we had a bipartisan support for the continent, which had tended to be the case. And I'm hoping that bipartisan support for the things that we do on Africa continue under this administration. And as my colleague here has said, we need to wait and see what happens this year.
Joe, it's for yours. What about you? You know Africa very well, much like on your fingertips, really.
Well, thank you.
What do you think should be done, honestly? Because there seems to be a lot of emphasis supporting individuals occupying state houses.
The problem with the United States policy in Africa is that there has been inconsistency over the last 30 years. I don't care how far you go back. I'll give you an example. Under the Obama administration, there was a coup in Egypt, full stop. But the United States did not call it a coup for the sake that we would have to impose sanctions on a national security interest of the United
States. Even though the African Union itself, in fact, called it a coup.
Unequivocally, there was a coup, and there was a man that was democratically elected there.
Precisely.
You have the same thing in the Palestinian territories, where there was someone that was elected. They happened to be of Hamas, considered a terrorist organization.
Joe, when it comes to Egypt, it's not the man that was democratically elected, perhaps the first man that ever to be democratically elected in that country, as a matter of fact.
And,
he's now in prison.
Right. So most Africans would consider Egypt part of the continent. So how is it that you treat one country one way and another way? You look at Rwanda. I mean, who gets 96% of the vote? I mean, only 98. So it's Saddam Hussein. Yet we treat Kagame with kid gloves because he's our local muscle in the region. So the reality is, if we want to be serious about Africa,
it's like a political military operation.
Yeah. So the problem is there's lack of consistency. And so when you treat one set of Africans against another set of Africans, how does anyone take it seriously? I mean, look at Burundi versus Rwanda. The Burundians are furious with us. Yet, if you look in Rwanda, you didn't have a free and fair election, 96%. You go to Equatorial Guinea, another election at 90-some percent. So
To Equatorial Guinea, of course, the longest-serving president in the world.
Right. So the reality is that we have different standards. I think once I heard you on the show say that your friends may change, your enemies may change, but your national interests remain, something along those lines.
Well, there's a saying that countries basically, you know, countries do not have either permanent adversaries or permanent allies. It is only, in fact, all you have is, you only have permanent interests.
Correct. And that's the reality of it. So as much as I would like to say, hey, let's treat Africa fairly, let's treat the people of Africa fairly, whom they deserve, this is not a reality of today. So whether it's national security, politics, economic interest, these three factors seem to dictate. So hopefully more, the reality is with anything in the world, you know, when you know people and you engage with them, you have a friendship. And when you have a good friendship, friends can overcome difficulty. So I think building friendships are the key. And through those friendships, in private, certain things can be, expressed in private if we're concerned about democracy or human rights issues.
But, can I just add to that?
Time is not a bestseller, Madam Ambassador. Let's first go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good afternoon, Ted. Good afternoon, Taylor. Well, it looks like he just dropped, so why don't you come in?
I would just say that, you know, following up on Joe's comment about us having different relationships with different African countries, that to me is very emblematic of just how we behave everywhere else in the world. It's not just endemic to the continent. We pick and choose our friends and we pick and choose our time. But what I'm arguing is that we need to be more consistent and support governments that are transparent, that have democracy, that have good election processes, and do the right thing. And it may take us a transitioning period to get there. And I think that as you have seen in successive U.S. presidencies, be they Republican or be they Democratic, we have made some strides forward on that. And I don't think that that can be discounted. So I'm hoping that we do the same thing going forward over the next 24 months.
Very interesting. When you look at, for example, the relationship between the Pentagon and State Department in the context of foreign policy, Where do you think, who do you think really guides the American foreign policy more? Is it the State Department or the Pentagon, or both?
Wow. Well, I worked at the White House a long time ago. And one of the ways that foreign policy is kind of dictated is through our National Security
Council.
After
all, it's called National Security
Council. Yeah.
Right.
So the National Security Council has a pretty heavy role in terms of being a mechanism. It allows the Defense Department, our intelligence agencies, our state and other agencies to weigh in. So I think it's done by group, but personalities go a long way too. So I think it fluctuates. Susan Rice was very influential with President Obama. Condoleezza Rice was very influential with President Bush. So individuals also have a pretty big role to play. So I think it varies from administration to administration.
According to Paul, who happened to be a general himself and the former chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, seems, frankly, to have been pretty much undermined by the then Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld.
Absolutely, without a doubt. I'm sure he regrets it.
Really?
I've worked at the National Security Council twice, as you know.
Yeah.
And I think that
you were in flux in charge of Africa.
Four of us working on the Africa desk. What I would say the perception is today, whether it's true or not, is that the power shift has moved to the Defense Department. For foreign policy and foreign policy implementation. Mm. That is the perception. Whether or not that's true or not, I can't say. But what I would like to see, though, is the State Department and diplomacy. It's really key to foreign policy. You can't disaggregate that. And one of the things I'm pleased about, you see a lot of former military flag officers or generals also having written to Congress about the importance of maintaining the State Department budget and the State Department role in diplomacy.
Very good.
And so, I just became a member of an organization called the American College of National Security Leaders. And it's with former diplomats as well as former flag officers. And one of the things that we are trying to do, along with the many other organizations and entities out there, is really talk about the important role of diplomacy.
I see.
Even though the perception may be that the power has shifted to DOD or Defense Department, if it has, it really needs to come back to the diplomacy aspect, and there's no better agency to do diplomacy than the agency mandated to do diplomacy, which is the Department of State.
Allow me, Madam Ambassador, to bring in a call from New York. Good afternoon, Tedla.
Yes, good afternoon, Shaka.
I'm hugely terrific. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Whatever Donald Trump said, it shouldn't really bother us. We Africans, we have to take care of our problem. We should not rely on anybody, be it the United States or China. What matters is for we Africans, we have to take responsibility and try to change our way of life. We have to do it. I don't expect anything to come from be it Obama or anybody or Trump. It is the ball is on our hand. We are born free like anybody else. So why should we always be a concern for anybody other than ourselves? We have to fight for our freedom. We have to organize. We are young, educated people, are tons of them. So why should we really be patronized by anybody?
Thank you very much, Tilda. It's very good that you agree with someone else who actually told me that that in fact he said Trump is not Africa's uncle. You got it? I think he has already left. Yeah, but when you look at what he allegedly says about African immigrants, I mean, let's face it, those were not facts because, let's face it, some of the immigrants who are most valuable here, in fact, are from Africa. Mm-hmm. The last time I checked, these are facts. The African immigrants as a community happens to be some of the most educated.
Absolutely.
In this country, not just among immigrants, but in fact in America. Is that correct?
I would agree with you.
Very interesting.
Yes.
What do you think he particularly looked at Africa, Haiti, and El Salvador?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's a big Haitian community in New York City, so maybe that's his previous interaction. But, you are a a product of your environment. So, like I said, he spent a lot of time in New York, and as you know, the Haitian community is quite vibrant in New York. So, maybe through that. But needless to say, if it was or wasn't said, you know, those are obviously the backlash was enormous, and I suspect that it was a lesson learned by the president, and hopefully he'll make it up to the continent with more time and affection.
And what do you think particularly attracted him to Norway? Because let's face it, Norway happens to be either number one or constantly in the top five among the annual UN Human Development Index. Right. They are very rich, very free. Not many people, frankly, would want to come to the
States. But I think that same week he had the Norwegian Prime Minister.
It was on his mind.
And they had a very good press conference in the Oval Office. He was very complimentary, so maybe because of the meeting.
The proximity.
Exactly, yeah.
Very interesting. Well, you know, any last words?
I do think the last caller made a very, very important point. It's you know, it's Africa first and Africans first for Africa. And so that has to happen. When you talked about state houses before and all of that, you know, the African people have to feel like they can elect democratic leaders, and it's Africa first for Africans. And he's right, they don't need us, but we need to have good partners, and Africa's one of those good partners.
Well, I think time is not a best ally. Yeah. I have to go for the orbit. Finally, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the passing of composer, legendary trumpeter, and anti-apartheid activist Huma Sekela. Yeah. The father of South African jazz, died at the age of 78 in Johannesburg on Tuesday after a long battle with prostate cancer. Voice of America had the honor to speak with the music icon a number of times over his five-decade career. Partly spent in exile, Huma Sekela recorded several hit songs, among them Bring Him Back Home, Soweto Blues, and the global 1968 hit Grazing in the Grass. South African President Jacob Zuma praised Huma Sekela, saying he kept the torch of freedom alive through his music, adding his contribution to the struggle for liberation will never be forgotten. Our sincere condolences to his family, friends, and fans around the world. He will be sorely missed, and may his soul last in eternal peace. I had the pleasure, not once, not twice, but three times, to sit down with the legend and interview him. On that note, thanks to my distinguished guests, Ambassador Robin Renee Sanders and Joseph J. Slavik. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, Today Break Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.